Cue the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Shoot the Fence. I'm your host, Stel. And my co-host this evening is none other than Bobby Hadgraft. You all right, Bob?
Yeah, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. Very, very excited about this show, and I'm sure you are.
Oh, me too. I'm so excited, especially studying journalism. This is, you know, everything I could wish for in an interview.
Fantastic. All right. Well, over the years on this show, we've had many incredible journalists on, you know, the likes of Harry Harris, Gab Marcotti, Tony Evans, and even Sean Wheelock, that's just to name a few. Now, getting this gentleman on the pod gives me the same feeling of satisfaction and relief as when I swapped four Shinies for a Luke Nyholt sticker, thus enabling me to complete my Premier League sticker book for season 93-94. It's the legend Dino. How you doing, Tim? You alright?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to kicking the ball around with the pair of you over the next few minutes.
Thank you very much, mate. I really appreciate it. And how are you coping with this whole COVID situation?
Well, luckily, I've got a very nice flat with a beautiful view. So, you know, mind me, heart goes out to people who are cramped up in horrible circumstances, because it's much harder for them than it has been for me. And I've got a little bit of a balcony, so there's a bit of sun in the morning. It's over by about 1 o'clock, but there's a little bit of sun in there. And I've got enough work just to keep ticking over to stop me really getting frantic. So I've got enough to keep me ticking over. And I'm well aware that there are many, many millions who are much worse off than I am.
And Brazil is an absolutely massive country. How are the people finding it at the moment? Did the government do enough to act on it quickly?
No, it's loony town. Oh, wow. Absolute loony town. Wow. And the central government, you've got to think about Brazil a little bit as being like a United States of South America, and it's a huge country. It's divided into states, into 27 states. The central government really don't care. And we, just because of legal reasons, we had a two-hour meeting. You were able to see a two-hour meeting of the government about a month ago, when the seeds were being sown for the disaster that there is at the moment, when the death toll is rising about 1,000 a day, and it's reached 24,000 now, and it's not a peak, it's a plateau. It's going to stay high for a while. And this meeting they had for 2 hours, I don't think they ever really considered it. The president's on record as saying it's a little flu, it's nothing to worry about. It is absolute loony town. It's one of those things that's made. If it wasn't for, I've got family here, and if it wasn't for that, I honestly don't know if I'd still be here.
Yeah, I don't blame you, mate. The thing is, I've got a friend who lives in Florianopolis, and I haven't spoken to him for a good 5-6 weeks, and I don't know what's going on there. And I'm quite worried.
I don't think it's too bad down there. And Brazil is huge. I mean, it's vast. It's continental dimensions. And there are four or five cities that are really suffering. One of which is Rio. Right. I don't think Florianópolis and the south is too bad at the moment. But you just don't know how it's going to go. I mean, the once it gets into the big cities, there's real problems, because a lot of the people live so closely together. You know, both, you know, with a lot of people inside a house, and that house being very near to other houses. So that's very difficult to contain once it does that. And there's also lots of evidence that it's spreading into smaller cities and towns. So I think we're in for a long, hard few months.
Well, fingers crossed it gets sorted soon, mate, because over here, we're none the wiser as to what's going on. It's bizarre. It really is.
Yeah, but at least it seems You're kind of coming out, maybe. The death toll is going down after all the mistakes that have been made and so on. You're we're behind you anyway. I mean, it reached us later than it reached Europe. But the worry over here is that we at the moment you just don't see an end in sight. The social distancing has never been done seriously enough to have the effect that it needs to have, and it just means that all the shops and so on have been closed probably for nothing, because you know you open, there's pressure now to open it all up. It will start opening up probably next month, and we'll just have another spurt again. So I don't know if you saw, but Donald Trump, who's supposed to be a big friend of the Brazil's president, he just stopped anyone from Brazil from travelling to the United States because he's looking at Brazil and thinking they just haven't got it under control.
Well, he's one of the most irrational people out there, to be fair, but that's the nicest way I can put it. But yeah, I don't know. I think with us, I'm sure you've seen the pictures of people going to Southend this weekend, and you're thinking another spike's gonna occur, isn't it? I don't know. I'm just very sceptical when it comes to things like this, to be fair. But
I sympathise, you know, because if you live in England and you go months and months without the sun, and the sun's there and you haven't got a garden, you're thinking, blah, I've got to take advantage of it, you know. So I do sympathise. It must be hard to walk the line, especially when you don't get good examples from on top.
Mm. Right, so let's talk about your career, Tim. Let's start from scratch. You're born and raised in London. I believe, if I remember correctly, I think we had a conversation a few years ago. Doesn't your mum live in Muswell Hill?
No, I'm from Hemel Hempstead.
You're Hemel
I'm from
Hempstead.
Outside.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a new town kid.
Okay.
That's out of Euston, that's what, 20, 25 minutes on the train from. So it was a great place to be a kid. Fabulous place to be a kid, because you know you're just surrounded by parks and stuff. You know, once you get to be an adolescent, then it becomes a bit more restricting, because it's far enough away from London not to have enough in common, and close enough to it to be in the shadow. So as an adolescent, there's just nothing going on. I was happy to escape when I did. I still go back visit my mum, and in fact, taking me wife over, Brazilian wife. She instantly fell in love with Hemel. She just thought it was great, and it made me see the place with new eyes. You know, I kind of saw it through her eyes again, as what it was supposed to be. Because when these towns were built, kind of London overspill, after the Second World War, they were like supposed to be kind of paradise for the working class. That was the idea behind them. And you know, she's from the working class suburbs of Rio, and she kind of saw that. So my relationship with Hemel, although you know I'm obviously there very very little, is much more healthy than it was when I was a kind of revolted adolescent, desperate to get out of the place.
Mm. Well, you've got Whipsnade Zoo, you've got the Warner Brothers Studio. You've got loads of things to do there now.
Yeah, Whipsnade. If you haven't got a car, I don't drive. You know, I was always a train kid. You know, so Whipsnade, I could never really get to that one. The Warner Brothers thing, I'm not sure it was there when I lived there. I mean, I moved out of Hemel in 1984, so you know, we're going back a long, long way, many years before Bobby was even born.
All right. So, how did you start supporting Spurs? I think Watford might be the nearest club to you.
Yeah, correct. But I've never liked Watford. Never liked them. The shirts were just so horrible. And horrible, horrible shirts.
What, yellow shirt, Tim?
awful. What are your teams before I start offending anyone?
Well, I'm from North London, so I've got to support Man United.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. What's your team, Bob?
My team isn't as successful. I'm Hull City supporter.
Right. Right, well, that's the Tigers. Good on you. Like most people's relationship with football, it came from my dad. My dad, he was a Tottenham supporter, but he wasn't really a supporter. He didn't know how to support. It just wasn't part of him. My old man was a player. He was a nearly man as a player.
Right.
And his life was football and cricket. It was football in the winter, cricket in the summer. And that was unbelievably important to him. I mean, to cut a long story short, he was born. He was old, my old man. He was past 40 when he married, which at the time was very, very rare. He couldn't get. They wouldn't let him in the war because he was very short sighted. And you know, he was a fit, athletic bloke. And not being able to get in the armed forces just killed him. It absolutely killed him, you know, because he was mates are going and fighting and dying for their country and so on. And he was in the Home Guard and working in Woolwich Arsenal during the day. And it destroyed him, really. But it meant that he put everything into sport. Sport was like where he proved himself, where he proved that there was nothing wrong with him, you know. So it was football in the winter and cricket in the summer. And he was a nearly man at both. I think he had trials for Charlton Athletic. He was recommended to Hampshire for cricket. And I was his oldest son. And I was supposed to, like, fulfil his dreams for him. I was supposed to, you know, be that bit better than he was. And I'd inherited all of the enthusiasm, but just none of the talent. None of the talent at all. So he used to come and watch me play football. You know, when I was tiny. And he'd just stand on the sidelines shaking his head. And I knew from a very, very early age that I wasn't going to make my living as a footballer. But I'd inherited the enthusiasm and I'd inherited the... My old man, he was very good at analysing the game. That's where all of his analytic skills went. You know, he didn't have a great deal of education, but he liked to watch football. He was great at spotting players and analysing players. And he was much more like that than he was a supporter. And he could never really understand that kind of passionate thing of a supporter. He always just wanted to watch the game rather than support a team. So he was a Tottenham supporter, but he wasn't a very good one. He wasn't a very good supporter of anyone. And he didn't take me very much. And by the time I was... He worked for the co-op. He worked in a shop. So he couldn't take me. He was working Saturdays. And he'd take me once or twice. But he hated it anyway, what it had become in the 1970s. He just despised it. So he didn't like going very much. So I didn't go very much when I was a kid. I played... much more, and I played a lot. I played very, very badly, but I played a lot. And then going back to the music scene, late 70s, it was really exciting, and I kind of drifted out of football a little bit. You know, it was always there. It was always part. I always played a little bit, but you know, at a certain stage in my life, you know, getting to about 14, 15, what was going on in music? It was punk and just after punk, and it was two-tone happening. There were so many things going on, and at the time, football lived in completely different worlds. There was total separation. And when you read the profiles of footballers and they would name their favourite musicians, it was always stuff like the Eagles or something like that. You know, it was never the music that was actually happening at the time that was really exciting. They existed in two totally different worlds. So at that point, football stopped being quite as important to me. And then I ended up going to college. And I'd never been abroad. I went to Warwick University, which is just outside Coventry. Because I could get there on the train. Well, that was the reason that I went there. It was the furthest north I'd ever been. It's unbelievable now, thinking of it. But what I did at college, I spent 3 years in the bar, and it was brilliant, great, because I was speaking to people from all over the country, not just all over the country, but all over the world. And it was a time there in the mid-80s where music started to lose it. It wasn't quite as exciting as it had been. And football, I just fell in love with it all over again, especially in the build-up and then during the 1986 World Cup. Because I was at college watching these games with people from all over the world. It kind of made sense. And I'd always been into like international football. You know, I'd always collected the sticker album from the World Cup and I'd really followed the international football. And I was about seven when I knew how to spell Czechoslovakia. You know, it's a skill that people don't need these days. But they'd reached two World Cup finals. How can you not know how to spell Czechoslovakia? Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, watching it with people from different countries and so on. And I remember playing football against these Algerians. These like Algerian beer boys. And they were brilliant. And, you know, this was when, you know, we used to have this kind of superiority. Oh, yeah, Algeria, if they go to the World Cup, it's just to make up the numbers, you know. And I'm playing against these blokes, and they're brilliant. And it blew my mind. And so it was during the 86 World Cup that I think it kind of vaguely put me on the path to doing what I've ended up doing.
Well, do you know what? I find it a little bit ironic in the sense that you got back into football during 86, and you being a Spurs fan, you kind of missed out on one of the best eras at the club. You know, the early 80s, winning the FA Cup, and then getting to the UEFA Cup final and winning it.
I didn't go very much. I went, but I didn't go very much in those early 80 years. But after 86, then I went mad on it. And I'll tell you why. One of the great things from 86 was the France team. which played a kind of 4-5-1 formation, just one striker and really packed the midfield and played beautifully. They lost in the semi-finals to them Germans. The France team were brilliant. And then straight after 86, after the World Cup, David Pleat became Tottenham coach, and he did exactly that. Based on the 86 World Cup, you know, based on what France were doing, he brought that formation to Tottenham. So it was like, it was really like a spiritual homecoming then. You know, all the parts were then fitting together, all the parts of my little identity. And then 87, I left college and then came, you know, back down to London. Those years, the late 80s and early 90s, that's the peak of me being a supporter.
Fantastic. Bobby, you got any questions for now?
Well, I'm really interested to hear how you kind of bridged that gap between university and then the move to Brazil. And I was also really curious about when you started that interest in languages, because there would have obviously been a barrier when you first moved. And I'm just wondering when you picked up those skills.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many things I can do, but languages kind of came easily to me in school. I only did French. I did German, which I hated, but French. And at the time, I could speak a little bit. So I knew that I had the capacity to learn a language. And I think some people just can't do it. I know really intelligent people who can't do languages. But for me, it's not too much of a problem. I left college, and really what I did over the next few years was like failed at everything. I mean, me and a few mates, we set up a magazine on the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, a kind of comedy magazine. And this was like 87. Comedy was a new rock and roll at the time. And anyway, so we kind of went down the pub and amused ourselves and wrote the magazine. And then we hired one of these very newfangled things called, you might have heard of them, called a computer. we kind of used a desktop publishing program to fix it all. It was quite a bit of time, really. And then we went off to the printers and got it printed. And then we wandered around colleges up and down the country, knocking on doors and selling it. And it was comedy, but there was some sport in there, and it wasn't bad. I mean, we went bust very, very quickly. Then we got an opportunity. Rory Bremner, he's still around, isn't he? The comedian. Yeah, he saw a copy, and he said, "Come and write for us. Come and write. I've got a new TV series. Come and write for my series down the BBC." So we thought, wow, you know, the gates of paradise are open. And then we went and did that. And I sat in these script meetings with people who went on to be famous, like David Baddiel and people like that. And I felt just like a player from the non-league football promoted to the Premier League and thinking, I am shit. I can't do this. I can't be a comedy writer. I'm just not good enough. You know, I'm not funny. So that was the end of that. You know, I just couldn't do it. And I found it torture, trying to be funny. You know, I found that I can understand why so many comedians have mental problems. It's you know. So at that point, I really had no idea what to do. And I spent time, you know, just living on people's settees and stuff, you know. And then purely by chance, a college mate of mine, it always comes down to who you know. You know, so often it comes down to who you know. A college mate of mine, she was working in a theatre in London's West End, and she said, you know, you need something. We've just got some part-time work. Why don't you come along? And I think I'd only ever been to the theatre once in my life, you know, to see something that I hated. I had no background in theatre whatsoever, but I went there part-time and ended up staying for years. I stayed worked in a box office for a while, and then I became like the theatre manager. And it was right in the heart of the West End, between Leicester Square and Covent Garden. It was like a kids' theatre during the daytime and an adults' theatre at night. And I ended up running the place, and I stayed, it was 5 years or something. And that was, I see that as like my second college, because right in the heart of London, I'm coming into contact with people from all over the world. It really did internationalise me. And I'd start, you know, going abroad, or, you know, a little bit to Spain or Portugal or, you know, stuff like that. And there was a bar downstairs in the theatre where it was just like full of Brazilians all working there. And we had these fantastic all-night parties. You know, some of the things really shouldn't have gone on in a theatre for kids. But, you know, why not? Why not? You're only young once. And it just made me very curious for Brazil. And I kind of realised that, you know, I wasn't going to spend my life managing a theatre. And if I lost that job, which was always a possibility, I couldn't do it in anywhere else. So they're some of the happiest times of my life, those early 90s years in London. It was just gloriously irresponsible, and I loved it. But I kind of realised it wasn't going to go on forever, and I had to, you know, I had to start thinking. So I thought, discover Brazil and discover Brazilians, and I went on a recce in 93. I spent 3 weeks in Brazil thinking, yeah, you know, let's have a look at that. And back to your language point, Bob. After those 3 weeks, you know, and not many people over here speak English, and even fewer people spoke English back in 1993. I came back, and one of my mates from the theatre, Brazilian guy from the theatre, we're wandering along having a chat, and he suddenly turns around to me and he says, "We're talking Portuguese." And I'm saying, "Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've been there for 3 weeks. I picked it up. You know what I mean? I picked it up very, very quickly. Really, really quickly. Again, just from what you have to do to learn languages, you have to want to talk and you have to want to learn. You have to listen as well. It's a test of your curiosity. I think picking up a language, you want to communicate in the full sense of both talking and listening. And that listening thing, there's no shortcut there. It's gonna give you a headache because you have to concentrate so much in order to make sense of what people are saying to you and try and differentiate where one word ends and the next one starts, you know. And it really is a hard, hard process doing that. But as I say, it came relatively easy to me. So after that 3 weeks, and I'd had some lessons with mates and that, you know, I had enough to be able to hold simple conversations. So I thought, all right, yeah, we'll do that. And then a year later, just after the 1994 World Cup, I took the plunge. All right, we'll go over there. There was a lot of stupid naivety in it, but you need some naivety. Otherwise, you don't do anything. Otherwise, you don't take the risks. And to start with, I came to Rio where I didn't know anyone. Mm-hmm. If I'd have gone to other places, if I'd gone to São Paulo, for example, I had, you know, people who knew me or family of people who knew me, and they'd have looked after me. And that's exactly what I didn't want. I didn't want to be looked after. I wanted to do it my own way. As I came over, now, again, this is something I wasn't prepared for at all, because in 1993, that they had this thing called hyperinflation, which meant that if you had pounds, everything was cheaper every day. I thought, right. Now, it was a disaster for Brazilians, but I thought, this is brilliant for me. You know, I'm going to live like a king. So I, you know, I only had about £1,000 on me, but I thought, that's great. But by the time I moved over here, just after the 94 World Cup, they brought in this new currency, which was pegged artificially high. And that meant that my money went very, very quickly. So that really was breadline stuff. And I'd done a course in teaching English as a foreign language. So I had that as a source of income. That just about got me through. But, you know, again, I was asleep. They have little maids' rooms here. In a lot of the houses, there's a tiny little box where the maid used to have, and most families don't have living maids anymore. But you know, that I was living in maids' rooms, you know, in a mattress on the floor, and so on. And there were times when I went hungry, there was certainly one time when the only thing that stopped me from going back to England was the fact that I didn't have any money. It was winter there. You know, how can I go back, a tail between my legs in February or something like that, when it's winter? At least here I can brave it out and enjoy the sunshine. But right from the start, I was struck by how different some of the things are from the myths that people had about Brazil. And I was also struck by how interesting the football was. And the level of club football was much better then than it is now, because fewer of the players moved abroad so early. So you had, there were lots of players. I remember the list of players that I saw in my first games here. And Roberto Carlos, you know, looking at Roberto Carlos, thinking, how's no one discovered him? This fellow is a phenomenon. Both Juninhos, the one who went to Middlesbrough and the one who ended up in Lyon. Rivaldo. There were so many of these players every game I went to. So I got hooked, and I thought, you know, there are stories to tell here. So I stuck at it, the more I learnt, the more I wanted to communicate, the more I wanted to write stuff, and I kept on sending stuff out and hoping it would get picked up somewhere. And now and again you'd have a little success. But I suppose that I had a big break. I got into World Soccer magazine. This is the start of 97. And I had a cover of World Soccer magazine. And that happened just at the right time because there was this TV show. It was being done by a production company for the BBC in 97, called Gary Lineker's Golden Goals. Lineker was going around the world, and he was obviously the top goal scorer in 86, and he was going around the world interviewing other World Cup top scorers and, you know, influential people. And obviously Brazil had to feature in this programme, and they were trying to sort that programme out from London without speaking Portuguese. Well, good luck with that. They weren't getting anywhere. And they saw this programme. They saw this, you know, my name on the cover of World Soccer. So they got in touch, and I ended up helping produce that programme. And that went very, very well. That was great. You know, we talked to all the old-timers and something, and that gave me more historical knowledge. And it also gave me one or two contacts. And based on that, summer of 97, when I came back to help them translate all the interviews, I then got into the BBC World Service, and that shortly afterwards led to Radio 5. So all of the pieces of that year, 97, was the year that that all of the pieces kind of fitted together. And really, that's the kind of wave I've been surfing ever since.
Tim, I've got a two-part question regarding languages, mate. Because I heard you mention before that you learnt Portuguese through your friends, and then you went to Brazil. Now, being English Cypriot, I wouldn't say it happens so much these days, but we're known as Charlies to the Cypriots out there. That's what they call us. That's a nickname after Charlie Chaplin, right? So there's this kind of, there's this air of arrogance about the Cypriots. Well, there was this air of arrogance about the Cypriots. They think, oh, because you're from England, you understand the traditions or the values or the language so much. Mm-hmm. So when you were learning Portuguese, did you learn Portuguese, or was it Brazilian Portuguese? Because there's a bit of a difference, isn't there, in terms of dialect?
Huge difference. Dialects, grammar, they're very, very different. I mean, Portuguese from Portugal sounds like something from Stalin's Russia. It's much, much less musical. No, it was always with Brazilians. And it was when I came over here to live, I found it very, very hard because, you know, my experience before, it had mostly been with my mates, Brazilians in London. They'd gone through the experience. They knew what it was like to operate in a second language. Mm. You know, because one of the key things, you know, when you're speaking to someone who doesn't have English as a first language, you have to moderate your language. You have to moderate your speed and your vocabulary. You have to be able to try and put yourself in the place of the other person. But if you've never had the experience of trying to get by in a second language, you don't know how to do that. Mm. So when I came over here to live, I found out very, very quickly that the vast majority over here had never had that experience. They'd never really spoken to foreigners before in Portuguese, and they didn't know how to do it. So I found it much, much harder than talking, you know, with my friends in London who'd also, you know, they'd shown a lot of patience with me. They knew I was learning and so on. And then you're dropped in a deep end, and it's not like that at all. And I was very lucky. I lived in a Brazilian context. I shared a flat, and the woman I shared a flat with, she had lots and lots of friends, and none of them really spoke English. So, you know, it was that thing of being forced, you know. Mm. And the thing that I really didn't want to do was try and live in an English context in Brazil. You know, what's the point of that? You know, I had to jettison that, and if that made things harder, well, that's just a bump on the learning curve. Mm. You know, because I think you really do have to immerse yourself, and there are no shortcuts, and it ain't easy. But once you've done it, it's a joy for life. You know, to be able to flip between the two languages and walk the two worlds. And these days, I do a lot of TV over here, and that's great. You know, to be able to do that. Every time I do that, every week I do that. You know, I go on and on TV in a second language. I always think to myself, you know, that's great. This is brilliant to be able to do that.
Oh, I completely agree with you, mate. And I'll tell you what, that leads me on to the second part of my question. Now, you said that 97 was a fantastic year for you, obviously. You know, it was the run-up to 1998 with the World Cup being in France and Nike getting involved in the Brazilian game. Now, you being from the UK, learning Brazilian or Portuguese-Brazilian, Did your peers see you as some sort of a threat? Were you treated different to a local journalist?
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, no, at first there was a lot of resistance. A lot of resistance. You know, who is this guy? Who do you think he is? I've been astonished about how little there is now about sticking it out. You know, there's a TV show now that I've done every week for 10 years now. And I'm amazed how the community, the journalistic community, have accepted me. But it wasn't like that way at the start. There are two reasons for that. I think one is that the longer you do something, the more you fit in. But also a lot of the journos have changed. You know, the generation who've now left the scene, you know, the generation who were running things, you know, when I first appeared 20 years ago or whatever, when I was first doing stuff, that generation weren't globalised at all. You know, usually they didn't speak English. They'd also been brought up on the World Cup wins of 58, 62 and 70. Mm. So they had an innate view of Brazilian superiority. You know, so they would see me as a Charlie, you know.
Right.
And also, they would have absolutely no respect for English football. And this is before the Premier League really took off. You know, there was real resistance. But that generation has gone now, and the generation that have come through since are more globalised. They've grown up with the Premier League and so on, and they're more international. So I'm frequently astonished at the extent to which I'm accepted.
And I guess it may be, this is just me guessing here, but it appears to have come full circle for you in the sense that the younger generation see you as their go-to guy, the mentor, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, the world changes, isn't it? And the state of affairs that I inherited is totally different from the kind of situation that say Bobby will face when you leave college. And it's just such a different world. And when I started this, there was no real internet. You know, the fax was kind of cutting edge technology. So a lot of the things that happened in my experience are simply not relevant, you know, to the next generation. You know, if people are looking to kind of copy what I did, I don't think that blueprint exists anymore. You've got to find your own blueprint. But I mean, the big advantage I think that the younger generation have with this is that they're more at home with new forms of media that people of my generation, we don't really understand. We don't really get it. So that I think is the advantage that the kids today have. They know much, much more, I think, about connecting. And when I came, I didn't know anything about anything, really. All I've done is just made it up as I've gone along. somehow I've managed to get away with it. I had much more kind of virgin territory than is the case these days.
Yeah. Well, see, this is it, Tim. And, you know, I don't mean to sound patronising to Bobby, but I think youngsters these days, they're not as street smart as us older generation. I mean, it's all well and good being an academic and getting your degrees and whatnot, but you still need that life experience. And I think that's kind of helped you get to where you are.
Yeah, without doubt. But on the other hand, they understand the technology. Mm. They understand the means of communication. So that's something that's in their favour. But also, yeah, but you have to live it. You have to live it. I mean, I've travelled. One of the things that was really important to me, because I mean, Brazil is very isolated from the rest of South America. It's the only country that speaks Portuguese. I quickly found when I started making a living that I would have to cover South America, which wasn't really the original intention, you know. And there's only one way to do that, and that's to wear out your shoe leather. You gotta travel. I've taken those horrible bus rides and stayed in those $2 a night places. I remember once doing a thing. I was in Colombia for the Copa America in 2001, and that was a fantastic adventure. And Colombia had never hosted a tournament like that before, and most people were scared of it at the time because it was just coming out of the loony years of the domination of the drug traffic. And I remember doing a kind of question and answer thing on a mobile phone during the Copa America from a hotel in the city of Cali. And I'd chosen it in a guidebook, you know. As I say, there was no internet. You used to buy a Lonely Planet guidebook or whatever and choose your hotels out of there. And I'd chosen it because it was very cheap and it was called the Hotel California, and that made me laugh. I got in early in the morning from Barranquilla. Barranquilla is very, very hot, and Cali's hot, but Barranquilla is very, very hot. So I was hot and sweaty, and I really wanted a bath, and I paid for one night up front, which is only like a couple of dollars or something like that. And then I went to switch the tap on, and you know, no water came out. So, I mean, it's horrible, sweaty and horrible and smelly in this Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave. I'm doing this Q&A session for the BBC World Service with people from all over the world asking questions. And behind the questions, I was thinking, you know, I get the impression that these people think I'm living a really glamorous life. And here I am sitting in a Hotel California, $2 a night and no running water. But you need those experiences, you know, that's really part of it. No, I got mugged at gunpoint outside a stadium in Rio. I had a gun pulled on me in Colombia. All of these things, you know, there's no shortcuts.
Unbelievable. Bobby?
So on the back of that, you say that you've travelled to the different kind of countries within South America. Yeah. Is there a particular league that you'd say is your favourite to spectate within the continent?
I suppose Argentina is great for the atmosphere in the stadiums, although the fact that there's no away fans obviously has a huge effect on the atmosphere. No away fans at the moment because of problems of football violence. But in some ways, Argentina is like the daddy of a lot of the South American leagues and going up to further north to Mexico. And football arrived here brought by the British, and the British got it very strong towards the south of the continent, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay. And it was the Argentines and the Uruguayans, but Uruguay is so small, who more than anything else, they carried it further north. And you really see this Argentine influence in a lot of the fan culture, a lot of the chants. All over South America come from Argentine football. A lot of the fan culture comes from Argentine football. So the atmosphere in stadiums, it's usually better than the game, you know, these days. The atmosphere, those songs, you know, they just stick in your mind forever and ever and ever. Another league that I think is really interesting is Colombia. Now, Colombia is interesting in South America because a lot of the South American countries are very centralized with only kind of one really big city that dominates. Colombia's more decentralized, so there's more cities, and football is a game of the city, so more cities means more big teams. So that means that the Colombian league, you know, because you've got a couple of big teams in Bogota, you've got a couple of big teams in Medellin, you've got a couple of big teams in Cali, you've got a big team in Barranquilla, and that gives it a kind of diversity that a lot of the South American leagues don't have. So I think Colombia is interesting as well.
And what do you think the key differences are between the fans in South America and, in particular, the leagues you've mentioned and English leagues?
Well, one of the great things to me about football is it's a universal language that we speak with different accents. Mm-hmm. People react differently to the same thing. You know, I'm talking of a Colombian. You know, when Tino Asprilla went to Newcastle, the Colombian striker, he couldn't believe how excited the fans got when there was a corner. You just couldn't believe it, you know, because, you know, for a Colombian, that's such a drag. Someone's got to go all the way out to the, you know, touchline to kick the ball in, you know. But the English fans, they loved it. It's, you know, it's because we've got that thing of the fans behind the goal, and it's that collective moment when, you know, everyone's trying to suck the ball into the back of the net. One of the things that works really well over here, and I think especially in Brazil, is like a nutmeg or a feint. Let's say that you've got the ball and you do a little feint and I fall on the floor. Now, that will get the fans absolutely crazy because in that minute, in that moment, I've been humiliated. Even if I can get on my feet straight away and I'm back marking you, I have been humiliated. And these are societies where humiliation is a very, very powerful thing. So that can really inflame fans. I mean, I've seen games change on something like that. You're thinking that was a little feint and it made him fall on the floor and it made no objective difference whatsoever. But it's changed the entire atmosphere inside the stadium. So that's one of the things that always fascinates me, the way that different fans in different places will respond to the same things in different ways.
So they wouldn't have anything to do with a diver then, would they?
Yeah. Well, no, diving's part of the game here as well. I mean, it's much more accepted. they don't really understand the English absolute hatred for divers, and there's also they kind of deep down, you know, they kind of love the idea of getting away with things. If you can get away with something, that's a little triumph, you know. And quite a lot of the, you know, you think of a kind of Diego Maradona figure.
Yeah.
You think of the hand of goal, the hand of God goal, you know, when he punches it in. He's managed to get away with it. You know, he's run rings around authority. and that plays really well here, you know. I mean, it's often said that, you know, the best way to win a local derby is, you know, 1-0 with a goal in the last minute that was offside. Because that just makes them even angrier, and it makes your pleasure about it even better. You know, if you beat them and you robbed them to do it, you know, that's even better. The idea of getting away with things, it's a bit like the abilities, the kind of street smarts that the kid on the ball on the wrong side of the tracks needs to get by.
So it's definitely not just the taking part that counts then, I suppose.
No, it really isn't. And so many people here have told me, you know, deep down, Brazilians don't like football that much. They just like winning. And I think the national sport of Brazil is winning. It's cheering the winners. That's another thing they don't understand that much with the British, you know, our love for kind of plucky losers. No, none of that here. You win. You win and then you rub it in the faces of whoever you beat.
It's literally by any means necessary. I mean, just ask Roberto Rojas, not our Paraguayan friend, Tim, the Chilean goalkeeper.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, win by any means necessary, and then bask in it for as long as you can.
That's it. Well, mate, you mentioned Faustino Asprilla, who seems to be a bit of a cult hero for Newcastle fans. One of my favourite, in fact, my favourite ever footballer, used to play for Man United, an Argentinian midfielder who was at Sampdoria, Parma, Lazio. He's the Estudiantes chairman, and that's Juan Seba Verón. Very underrated, in my opinion. I think he was very unlucky in England with injuries and playing in such a good Man United side. I don't think Fergie knew exactly where to play him. And what filled me with a lot of joy when he signed for the club, it wasn't because he's my favourite player at the time to join United, but his dad also played for my favourite Greek team, Panathinaikos, back in the 70s. So that's my like allegiance there. When you talk about cult heroes, who would you say is the most popular in South America?
I think it's entirely done on a national basis.
Mm.
You know, each country will have its own. Romario's unbelievably popular in Brazil, especially he's a little turd in many ways, but that's why they like him, you know, because he did what he wanted to do and he didn't do anything else. He kind of lived out people's fantasy for them, and there's an aspect of that in Diego Maradona. I mean, those two goals he scored against England, they changed his life. It's the day, I know it's only a World Cup quarter final, but it's the day that changed his life, because it's the day that he becomes a god, because the manner of the two goals and the opposition. Now, if you're from Argentina, South America was a kind of unofficial part of the British Empire. The British had reached the point where they kind of realised that you don't need to occupy the place militarily in order to dominate it. You know, and occupying it militarily gives you lots of costs. Mm. All you need to do is dominate its finances, and then you've got them by the short and curlies. So it's an informal part of the British Empire, which is one of the reasons that football arrived here. And so Argentina's on the wrong end of a kind of colonial relationship. And the English kind of have the formal power, but you're the little kid who's running rings around them. And the first goal, you know, the one that he punches in with his hand, that kind of proves, you know, deep down, they might have the formal power, but we're smarter. And then the second, when he dribbled the entire defence, that just said, that kind of proved that we're better anyway. So that was living out an Argentine fantasy. You know, scoring two goals in that way against those opponents, you couldn't have a better script for an Argentine. And in Brazil, everything that Romario did when he didn't want to train, and he gets away with it. You know, he gets away with it because a lot of people here live very, very restricted lives. You know, you're thinking of the big cities. People get up 5 o'clock every morning, so, you know, even earlier to get to work on time. And, you know, it's like 3 hours to work, 3 hours back. And you look at someone who comes from that background who manages to get away with anything that he wants to, that makes him a cult hero as well. So I think the cult of Romario is very, very strong in Brazil, and Maradona is even stronger in Argentina.
Mm. Okay. Well, I've got a question based on technology, as you mentioned earlier, and social media being the main one, and I'm sure you're sick to death of this as well, the Messi-Maradona comparisons. It happens all the time on social media, and as you've probably experienced yourself, trolls. And how do you handle people like that, and what would you make of this comparison between the two players?
Well, they're very, very different people, aren't they? Very, very different people. Messi's a kind of Maradona for the PlayStation age, yeah. You know, the age where people are perhaps less social, perhaps more individualised. You know, they've got more technology to keep them in their own little space. So he's not as vocal. He's trying hard, actually, towards the end of his career. This is one of the big disappointments about not having football at the moment, that we're missing out on a Messi who's really working in now the twilight of his career to try and become a leader. A vocal presence, something that doesn't come naturally to him. I don't mind the comparisons that much, as long as they don't become adversarial. I hate it when one is used to attack the other. When we're talking about this level of greatness, let's celebrate the amount of pleasure that these people have given to millions. So as long as it's kept in that spirit, I don't mind it too much. Well, with social media, it is what it is. I mean, it's given me, and I was very slow to get into it, but it's given me much, much more pleasure than the you just screen out the idiots, and there are lots of them. But that's the price you have to pay, I suppose, for giving everyone an opportunity to voice their opinion. Yeah. But I've made friends through it. I've learned so much through it. You've got to be thick-skinned enough, I think, if you're on the receiving end. You've got to be thick-skinned enough just to bat some of it off, you know. And there was once or twice when it really, really got me angry. One person once accused me of child abuse, you know, because he didn't like an opinion that I'd given on a player who played for his club. And I actually thought then, you know, should I sue him or something, you know, and let it slide. As the years have gone by, I found it easier just to let that kind of stuff slide and keep hold of the positive bits, because, you know, there's so much information comes to you through social media, and there is the chance to make contact with people. So for me, the good has far outweighed the bad. Mm. Although, you know, for people who are really on the end of horrible stuff, especially at a much, much younger age when you're still a personality in formation, I think that must be very difficult to cope with. Mm-hmm.
And I guess for you, Bobby, being a female, you get the brunt of it as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of stereotyping, you know, a lot of people, when they kind of want to come back at an opinion that I make, they'll just say, oh, get back in the kitchen or something. It's so
original. Do you still get that? Does that still
happen? Yeah,
seriously. Blimey.
I know. I just have a question on the back of the social media comment, because something that was quite big on social media last year was the whole Spygate scandal. And I was going to actually ask, you know, what your thoughts on Bielsa were as a manager from Argentina.
Good. That's good. That's a good question. Very good.
I'll tell you the first time I ever saw him. It was the Copa America 1999. And he was coach of Argentina at the time. And it was a game where it was a group game in the Copa America. His team lost 3-0 to Colombia, and he'd been sent off. And his centre forward, Martin Palermo, had missed three penalties.
I remember that one.
I'd heard about him. You know, he'd already won the Argentine championship with Vélez. So I knew a little bit about him, but I'd never seen him. And I'd heard he was a little bit strange. So I went to the press conference afterwards. And, you know, that thing that you've since discovered, he's just staring at space. You know, he's not making eye contact with anyone. He looks a little bit as, you know, as if there may be some mental issue there. The first question is... you know, it's been a very controversial game. Marcelo, what did you make of today's referee? And he's just staring into space, and he says, and in that very florid Spanish, It's very hard for the fella to translate him, you know, that fella who works with him at Leeds. He says, well, one doesn't have the habit of commenting on the activities of the match day officials. But, he continued, in respect to today's referee, you know, and I'm thinking there now, he's going to say this fellow was a joker who should never be allowed out with a whistle in his life. But no, instead he said, in respect of today's referee, I would like to say that my expulsion was absolutely correct because I protested in an ill-mannered form. You're thinking, wow, you know, bring this on. This is something different. This is something wonderful. So, no, I love him. I think he's great. I think he's terrific for the game. I think he's someone who ennobles football with his presence in it, with his you know, I entirely understand his position on Spygate. It's something that he's always done. He's from a culture where that's considered absolutely normal. There are some cultures now over here that use drones, you know, to try and fly over opposition training sessions. So he gave that long press conference when he put it all into the context of what little actually that adds, because he's already got a huge database and a picture of how the opposition play. But he said, you know, okay, if this is considered out of order in this football culture, then I won't do it again. So it was a great way for people to get inside his mind. And there's something almost endearingly adolescent about Bielsa. There's something, you know, the way when you're an adolescent, things, you really see things in terms of purity. And I think he sees football as something really, really pure. I love him, and I'm really glad that you lot are getting a chance to meet him. I remember going back now, this must be 4 years. This is late 16, 2016. I was in a ground for Brazil against Argentina. In a World Cup qualifier, and Argentina's former captain Juan Pablo Sorin, he was a captain in I think the 2006 World Cup, left back. He's there, and he knows me from TV, so we come and have a chat. And at the time, England were doing very badly, he said, "You know, what's happening with England?" And I said to him, "You know what I think? You know what I think should be England coach, Marcelo Bielsa." And this is well before Bielsa is on the radar screen with Leeds or anything else, you know. And he just looked at me for a minute and he said, "You know what? That's brilliant. That's brilliant. But please, I don't want it to ever happen." And I said, "Why not?" Because he said, "Because I don't want to have to support England. You know, I'm from Argentina. I'm never gonna support England." And I just wonder what the future might be for him now at Leeds. You know, where is he going to go after? I would love to see him coach an England national team. I think it would be fantastic.
I wouldn't be surprised if he, you know, promotes Leeds. It's looking very likely, and you know he's got a global platform. Then once he gets Leeds to the Premier League, it's definitely a possibility.
But he is the high priest of glorious failures, because he works his team so hard as well. It's such high intensity that they usually run out of steam towards the end. So this enforced pause, it might have done Leeds some good. They might have more gas in the tank now for the home stretch if indeed it is played.
Absolutely, but I don't really think they need any extra help at the moment, looking where they are in the table. Either way, as a Hull fan, we have a bit of a rivalry with them. So, as much I'm a bit like the guy from Argentina that you mentioned, that I'd love to see. You know, I'd love to see him manage a team in the Premier League, but I'd rather it wasn't Leeds, unfortunately.
Very good, very good. Well, Tim, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've got a couple quick questions to ask you. I'm going to sidestep here. The World Football Phone-In, a podcast I've been listening to for, I've got to say, 10 years now, 9 years. It's been a breath of fresh air listening to every single show. I love the chemistry between you and Dotton, the interaction with the guests. It's an absolutely superb listen. And I remember a few weeks ago, in fact, it was way before COVID-19 put a halt to the show, Dotton started singing again. And that's the one time I feel like just fast-forwarding, because as much as I love the guy, he's got to stop this. And as I'm driving, he's telling this story about a Cypriot friend of his and how he taught him a bit of Greek and this and that. And he said something like "sira sira," which means slow down. And he goes "sira sira mavro." Now mavro is like, it's the equivalent of saying negrito, so to speak, right? And when he said that, ooh, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, because I'm like, this is live on air. I know it's a podcast, but you said it live on air, right?
And so that's a word you can't say mavro.
Well, mavro is kind of okay. It means black, the color black, right? But you can also use it in a derogatory term as well. So yeah, so it works both ways. So I presume his friends were calling him Mavro as a joke, but to people that don't know, it's like So yeah, I had this discussion with Troy Townsend because his son Andros is half Cypriot. So
yes.
Yeah, so yeah, when what's it like with Dotson? Because as I said, he's so lively, so jovial, when he knows his stuff as well. I mean, especially when he starts talking Swedish.
He's like a big Baloo the Bear figure. He's everyone's uncle. He's uncle to the whole world. Mm. He's a lovely fella, and it's a joy to be in harness with him. You know, it just works. The chemistry works. I love the fella. I think he's great. He's got such a big heart. But don't cross him. He'll give you a Baloo the Bear hug that will crush your ribs, I think. He's great. And it's tough being off the air at the moment, because we're getting all these messages on social media. People want the show back. We want the show back. There's some kind of bureaucratic questions at the moment. But maybe we'll branch out and do something on our own, and while we're waiting or something, because it seems a shame to, when you've got chemistry like that, don't waste it.
No, absolutely. I agree. Bobby?
Well, my final question would be back, kind of like circled round to the first mention of the lockdown. I've seen some of your recent articles for ESPN about the Brazilians being impatient to see the national game up and running again. And I was just wondering to hear more on this, and whether you could expand, and just what does the pressure feel like for you as someone living there? Is that quite frightening?
It's complicated because you've got different levels of government pushing in different directions, and you've got different football teams pushing in different directions. It's so different from the Germany situation, you know, where Germany has gone back to football with a relatively, compared to its neighbours, a relatively small death toll, and coming out the other side. All right, it could end up being premature, and they might have to go back. But you know, it's a concerted effort with everyone's boats sailing in the same direction. At the moment in Brazil, it's not like that at all. The central government would love football to come back. Some of the regional governments really don't want it. Some clubs are desperate to come back. Others are saying it would be like murder to come back this soon. So it's very, very confused. And the whole thing, to my mind, it just seems premature. And to think about a restart of football while the death toll is still going up, I think that's, and especially the mystery to me is the club who are most pushing for this. It's Flamengo here in Rio, who were the current Brazilian and South American champions. And all right, they've got a lot of money, so they can do things in terms of testing their players all the time. They've got resources to do things that a lot of the other clubs just haven't got. Even so, their massage guy, he was their massage guy for 40 years. He died 2 or 3 weeks ago of coronavirus. And you would think that might be enough just to, you know, surely this is premature. Surely this is premature. So I'm worried about how everything, you know, because you would really like, at least from football, you would like as much unity as possible at the moment. And as it stands, when especially Flamengo and Botafogo are just trading insults, it's not a healthy situation. Obviously, from a personal point of view, I would like football back as soon as possible. It's how I make my living, and I've lost a significant part of my income as a result of the absence of football. But it's not an essential service, and if it's not safe to do it, if there are doubts about whether it's safe to do it, you know, surely it's better to hold on. But at the moment in Brazil, football is very much a political football.
So would you say that the clubs have more of a political influence than they would, say, a Premier League side here?
Yeah, I think that they probably do. And they're also more selfish. There's less conception. And what there is in the Premier League, there is a conception that it's a league. you know, because a football club is not like a normal business. It must have. You know, a normal business, I suppose, would like 100% market share, wouldn't it? You know, if you make Coca-Cola, you'd be happy to drive Pepsi-Cola out the market and have 100% to you. But a football club can't work like that. It's got to play against someone, and then someone different the next week and someone different the week after. So this is the thing that worries me about the way that Brazil has responded to coronavirus, the lack of collective action. You know, you've got to get all the levels of government thinking the same way. You've got to get all the football clubs thinking the same way. And at the moment, that really isn't happening.
I can totally understand, especially, you know, as kind of the influence goes. I've seen a lot of negative things about the Brazilian Prime Minister not setting a great example. But just on to Stel, your last question.
Well, I didn't want to waste it by asking which film do you prefer, Elite Squad or City of God? In terms of South American players in obscure countries, Tim, we've seen the likes of Shakhtar Donetsk in the Ukraine take on a whole heap of Brazilian players. Yeah. They've done remarkably well with players like Tyson, Villian, etc., etc. But I've seen a lot go to Greece and especially Cyprus, which is the country of my parents. As I said before, like Kavanagi was there, Jardel spent some time there. I think Zelias, who is, I think, with ESPN now, he was at Omonia.
Yes, yeah.
What is it that draws these players to these countries? I mean, let's be fair, I mean, Cyprus don't pay top dollar for players, so I don't think it's just money. Do you think it's just a nice little retirement place, to, you know, nice weather and quality football is pretty good for them?
Well, the big push factor to get them over to Europe is money. Mm. Also, in terms of the big clubs, it's, you know, to be recognised as a great player by other great players. You can't do that these days if you stay in South America. You know, in order to be recognised as a great player by other great players, you've got to do it in one of the big European leagues. Now, that means that no one is really going to choose top of their list to go to either Greece or Cyprus. Mm. But if that's where the bid comes from, you know, it's either a very nice place to live on the way down, or maybe, you know, we can do well there and we can attract the interest of someone else and go on the way up. And I would love to spend some time in Cyprus. You know, I've never been there. I would love to go there. It's, you know, it sounds fantastic. One of my mates, primary school, was he left as a result of the conflict with the Turks in the mid-70s. Lost contact with him years and years ago. In fact, remade contact on social media a couple of years ago. He used to tell me, you know, it just sounded beautiful. I can think of a lot worse places to earn a living.
Mm, fair enough. Well, actually, I've got one more question, and you probably know the answer to this straight away. I don't know if you heard, but a couple of years ago, the PAOK chairman, Savidis, stormed the pitch with a handgun because he wasn't happy with a decision against his team.
Yeah.
I spoke to Simon Edwards about his top five favourite matches. He mentioned the game with Nacional, a last-minute winner, and there was a massive pitch invasion. In terms of people owning football clubs, have you ever seen them getting physically involved in a game?
Yeah, I've seen a game, this is going back more than 20 years, when both of the club presidents ran onto the pitch. It was Vasco and Botafogo, and both of them ran onto the pitch at different moments to protest about the refereeing, and both of them were extremely fat. So just to see him run across the pitch was so funny. And there's a saying over here that the penalty is so important that the club president should take it. And I remember thinking that at this time when I was watching these kind of fat presidents waddle onto the pitch, thinking, well, which one of these two would I back if it went to a penalty shootout between both of them? But unfortunately, they weren't asked to do that.
Fantastic. Well, Tim, it's been an absolute honour having you on the show, mate. Can't thank you enough for giving us over an hour of your time. It's incredible.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I'm not going anywhere.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Great stuff. Well, I was going to say, before we let you leave, would you like to tell us your Twitter handle? But they're listening in for you anyway.
You call it underscore, didn't you? It's underscore, it's Tim underscore Vickery. So what could be easier?
There you go. Wonderful. Bobby, what could be easier?
Oh, mine's fun, isn't it? So I think I should just spell it. So it's B-O-B-B-I-H-A-D-G. And it's like my name, but then half my surname. I think I should change it, to be honest. But there you go.
You'll change it one day, I promise. Well, that's it for us this week. Thank you again, Tim, for joining us. It's been fantastic. And yeah, we're on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We also have an Instagram page. And that is it. So until next time, take care.